The other CEO bit was really interesting for me because I think you can be really quite arrogant when you become a CEO. You know, all of a sudden I've made it. I came from the project of thinking, I've made it. Shit, somebody's going to discover me. You know, you're going to be really rubbish. Help. And I found that the CEO was unbelievably helpful and so generous with their time just to say, God, I remember when I took over and these are all the things that, you know, I learned. And all of a sudden you're able to speak to somebody else who's been through the same experience as you.
Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching. I'm Rachel Sullivan.
And I'm John Tattersall.
Hello and welcome to episode 46 of the Building Better Leaders podcast. We're nearly at 50. Can't believe it. We've got an absolute cracker for you today, an absolutely wonderful guest in the form of Peter Pritchard, the Group CEO of Pets at Home, one of my all-time favourite stores. I'd just like to give a really big thank you and a shout out to Harry Corbett of the Intelligence Forum, a networking group that I am a member of, who introduced me to Peter, and that's why we've got him on the podcast. So big thank you, Harry. You are amazing. So just a quick heads up, on this podcast, we had a few issues with the microphone for the first minute of the podcast where Peter's speaking. Please bear with us. We sort it out about 90 seconds in and the sound is then perfect after that. So it's not got that rustling in it all the way through. Peter was absolutely amazing. If you are in a leadership role or you're wanting to be a CEO one day, there's just so much wisdom in this podcast. He talks all about building trust in an executive team, about the different approach that they take to leading the organisation rather than a function. He talks really openly about being a gay CEO. We asked him permission if we could ask some questions around this before we did this interview. So we do talk about that. We also talk about his quite unique upbringing and his very different approach to really caring for his employees at Pets at Home. We also talk heaps about the phenomenon that was getting a pet during COVID. It's a wonderful conversation. I hope you enjoy.
Welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast. Today we are in esteemed company. This is the first time that we have a group chief executive representing a FTSE company. And so we're delighted to be joined today by Peter Pritchard of Pets at Home. Peter, welcome to the show. Would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Hi, everybody. I'm Peter, as you said. I'm the Group CEO of Pets at Home. You'll know us as a pet shop. Actually, we're probably a little bit more than a pet shop. We've got 450 pet care centres, we call them, across the country. We also have 450 veterinary practices as well. So increasingly, the non-pet shop part of our business is becoming as big as our pet shop part of our business. And actually, what we're trying to be is a pet care operator, because actually ultimately we recognize our role in life is to serve pet owners, and their job as pet owners is to care for their pets. So I've been at Pets for 11 years. I initially joined as the commercial director, and I've been the group CEO for the last four. And prior to Pets, I spent most of my life from the age of 16 working in various retailers that you would have heard of: Wilko's, Asda, Sainsbury's, Marks and Spencer, Iceland. So I've been serving customers since the age of 16.
When I was doing a little bit of research before the podcast, Peter, I've heard that you say you're not a retailer. It's not the way to describe it. You've described it as something else. And I found that quite interesting. What exactly is that phrase?
Well, I don't know what phrase you've heard, but I think what I would say is our job really is about solving problems.
Right.
I think anybody in, you know, I think when you think of a retailer, you think of a shop, don't you? But I think actually anybody who's serving customers, your job is about understanding their needs and addressing their needs and fixing their needs. And I think in our language, you call that retailing. But actually, I think retail has become so diverse now. You know, you might think of us as a retailer, but you can come to one of our stores and we can, you know, we can castrate your cat. Is that retailing? I'm not sure. I think it's part of the service provision that we give our customers, or, you know, you bring your dog as Rachel does and we groom your dog. So I think what we recognize our job, and I think it really made us think about our business as we sort of rethink about our business, we recognize actually our business is about pet care. That's what we are. And it so happens we've got shops and surgeries and grooming salons, but actually our job is really simple. Our job is about pet care, because ultimately when a pet owner comes to our store, the job that they're doing is caring for their pet. Whatever their budget, they're trying to care for their pet as best as they can. And the reason why you work in our business, you wouldn't work in our business if you didn't like pets, would you? I mean, you'd be absolutely mental. We wouldn't recruit you for a start. But we recruit people who actually want to care for pets too. And therefore, it gives us this amazing alignment with our customers that we are able to bring our expertise, our knowledge, our passion, and bring it to our customers who are trying to do the same thing for their pets.
Has that been a philosophy for a long time then at Pets at Home? Or because I also read about when your first year as a CEO, you spent quite a bit of time with other CEOs from all sorts of different backgrounds and what have you. And I wondered, how did you sort of find that as a something to do and the benefits that you got from it? Yeah. And B, whether that's been useful in terms of actually leading the business in terms of all the information that you were managed to glean.
No, it's a great question, because when I took over the business, the mission of the business was to be the best pet shop in the world. And that describes the what you do. And it was a subtle change, but a really important change, is I changed our focus on being the best pet care business in the world. Because actually what I was trying to do is move the emphasis on to why and create more of a purpose-led focus for the organization. And I think when you become a CEO, the first thing is, there's not a manual. I became CEO for lots of different reasons, a combination of need for the business and, the timing was right and the magic moment sort of happened and you become the CEO. And you sort of want to get a book off the shelf, don't you? The 15 steps you should do when you become a CEO, and unfortunately it doesn't exist. And then everybody tells you what you should be doing. And then you're thinking, bloody hell, this is a bit scary. I'm in charge. I feel something very grown up. And I had quite a lot of support around me, actually. I had quite a lot of development support around me. And the one thing that really stuck was about purpose, really connecting your purpose, to the purpose of the organization. And it really made me think about what was the purpose of the organization. Because I think often businesses describe themselves as the what, being a pet shop, being a vet, being a groomer. That's the what you do. It's not the why. And I think I've learned, and again, just lots and lots of experience, I always try and start off with the why. Why are we doing this? Why do we get out of bed in the morning? And then it's so much easier to put the what and the how and the when into context, because people go, oh, I get it. Yeah, no, I agree with that. And it just enables conversations. And that subtle change, and it was a fundamental change of the business, by the way, when we talked about being a pet care business, because it united the organization. And I there's always three things I talk about when I describe our statement, whether it's a mission or a purpose. You can get into the odds of what it is. But actually, when I describe it, there's three words I always focus in on. The first one is best, because in order to be best, you've got to be better. It could be better than yesterday, better than the week before, better than last year. And better never stops. What was better today, tomorrow can be rubbish because somebody does a better job. So better is about a mindset. Pet care I've talked about, which is about, it's why we get out of bed. If you don't care for pets, you shouldn't be in this organization. It's the wrong place for you. Go and get a job at Aldi or Asda or somewhere else, because pet care is the why we do things. And then the word world, often people think that's about global domination. Pets at Home want to take over the world. No, the word world for us is about an outward perspective on looking outside the organization and learning from outside and asking ourselves the question, how do we bring it inside? Because our customers are the customers of lots of other businesses, Amazon, Sainsbury's, Tesco, ASOS, whoever. And their experiences and their definition of good is set by other people. And therefore, if we're always looking outside and learning from those and then asking ourselves, how do we apply that back to our business in pet care? And how does that help us be better? We become a better organization. So that's why we came up with that phrase. It was simple, really powerful, but you then know when it works is when the organization plays it back to you all the time. And I think for me, that was the real test of the organization is constantly playing back to me why what we're going to do is going to make us the best at pet care in the world. And I think that's a really hard thing to do, but it actually comes from actually often absolute simplicity of description of what it is you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, Peter, I really, really like that. And I think particularly how big the organization is, it needed to be simple, and the type of people that work for you, you needed everybody to get it. I think the thing that's interesting about that word world and pet care is how much the world changed during COVID, but also how much our perception of the role of pets and pet care changed. How prepared were you for that absolute massive shift in all of a sudden pets just became this forefront? Everybody wanted one. Your pet became a real safety beacon, a real sense of joy. How did that change the business? How ready were you for it? And yeah, what was that like?
Yeah, it was funny. I think all organizations have their, you know, their emergency plans. I'm not sure we had one called pandemic.
I didn't think you would.
No. So I do remember when we knew that this was getting really serious. I remember as an exec team, we were in a meeting in this building, and we knew that life was about to change. We just had no idea for how big and for how long. And we wrote a list of 9 objectives of going into this crisis. What were the 9 things that we needed to really focus in on? And it was a combination of super practical things, but also a real focus on what was important. And we used that list of 9 all the way through the whole of the pandemic. We constantly referred back to, do these things, these actions we're going to take, help us focus in on what we've deemed to be important? And of course, at the start of the pandemic, you know, nobody's thinking about you know, whether people are going to get more pets. Actually, we built a whole series of scenarios that was all about doomsday. I remember that we named them all after sort of various stages of badness, from the point of view we had ice age to winter to frost. We had 3 scenarios. We never had a spring or a summer or a heat wave. And we ended up in heat wave, which is ironic, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we built loads of scenarios like lots of business do. So you can try and imagine what you might need to cope with. And actually, scenarios are a great way of helping you imagine what you need to deal with. But our very first focus, and the number one objective, by the way, at the very top of our list, was about people. Recognizing it's about how do we keep people safe, but more importantly, recognizing that if our people are unable to come to work or didn't feel safe or didn't feel looked after, we'd have no business. And you know, I sort of think that when we went through the pandemic, and certainly the early stage of the pandemic, we spent all of our time focused in on people-y stuff. We just frankly forgot about profitability. We forgot about cost. We recognized that if we manage that early stage really well to get our people feeling really comfortable and safe and protected, they'd look after us. And actually that played out. About 2 months into the pandemic, we suddenly started to see some really strange things happening. You know, so you begin through remember we had that whole panic buy, and then we had the whole lockdown. And of course, you're trying to make sense of what's going on. And then all of a sudden, we started to see some really strange things happen. And of course, what we're starting to see is people recognizing that their lives had changed, and they were getting pets. And we saw it first in search metrics, where people were searching on our website for puppy things. And that's always the first indication. And when somebody looks for a puppy cage on our website, you know, there's a puppy coming. It's one of those things. And the search metrics started to boom. So we started to recognize something was changing here. And I do remember we suddenly changed our mindset. At one meeting, we said, right, the crisis-y bit, we've done all the emergency things we need to do. We've got 2 choices now. You know, the ice age, the winter and the frost, we suddenly realized none of those were going to play out. We actually recognized that this could be growth. And we changed our entire mindset completely as an organization, as an exec team. And then we focus actually, what do we need to do to enable the organization in case actually what may happen is a bit of a boom. Now, we didn't know whether it would or it wouldn't, but the indications were starting to say something's going on. And of course, you then start to speak to family and friends, and you start to realize that, you know, well, people are suddenly saying, well, if I've got a dog, I can go for a walk, because it's one of the reasons I was allowed out. All of a sudden, I'm at home. I've always wanted to get a pet, but actually my home life didn't support it. And actually, I think that's going to change. And then you recognize, of course, and we get this, one of the reasons why you get a cat or a dog is companionship. And at a time when everybody was thoroughly miserable and lonely, actually pets play a really important role in your life. And for us, that was second nature. We get that. So we started to think we may actually start to see a degree of a boom. So we took some really brave decisions. We went from preserving cash and we made three or four of the biggest investment decisions we've ever taken in our entire history. Because what we then started to say is, this is probably an opportunity here to think about the signs are showing that actually this market is probably going to grow. How do we move first and what do we need to do? And it was a very, you know, it was probably one of the, some of the bravest decisions we ever took, because we didn't have all the information, but we recognized speed and using our instincts and reading the signs well and speaking to people and understanding would serve us well. And they did. And then we called it right. We didn't call it, actually, it ended up being bigger than we thought, I have to say. Mm. But we called it right and actually changed our mindset completely around this is now about grow as fast as you can, because these opportunities, you know, for us, what we've seen is a structural change, fundamental structural change in the pet market. And all ships will rise in a rising tide, but we wanted to rise faster. And that required us to invest in capacity and capability and in people and resources. And that meant we had to take some pretty bold decisions and be quite risky.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you think about it, I suppose purpose has to move at the speed of cultural change. And it's like your purpose was already aligned for where the cultural change was going, even though nobody knew where it was going to go. Mm. It's just so remarkable that you were able to recognize those early stages, because I certainly know from when I first got my dog and my puppy, Pets at Home is the place that just makes you feel safe. Like whether or not you stay with them forever, you know, you might go and get another groomer or this, but actually it's the one place where you know nothing. You feel like you might get some care. Mm. And how remarkable that was what you managed to do. Mm. I am interested in those leadership discussions that happened in that time. So talk us through. It cannot have been as plain sailing as how you just eloquently described.
Oh, God, no, it was absolute. It was, I have to say, when I look back, I actually thought, I'll probably kill things. I actually thought COVID was exhilarating, because it was almost like one of those, we were convinced that there was a Japanese film crew in the corner somewhere filming us, you know, like those Japanese endurance game shows where you get put through. It sort of felt a bit like that, because, you know, it was uncharted, at times absolutely absurd, the things that were happening, but you had to continue to make decisions and move on. And I have to say, you know, and you're in the chair and you're leading this, you know, so you are absolutely at the forefront of leading this disaster program. And the one thing I remember thinking was saying, and it was a piece of learning I had from somewhere else, actually, when in the face of uncertainty, narrow your time frame right down. Think about what you need to do in the next second, 10 seconds, minute, 10 minutes, day, week, month, and you extend your time zones out as you feel more and more comfortable. So I remember we established this pattern in the organization where we said, right, we're going to meet in the morning and we're going to meet in the night. And the point of a morning was really for us to see what had happened overnight. What was it we had to deal with today? We would then, by the end of the day, have made all the decisions and we communicate it to everybody. So everybody knew what you had to do tomorrow. And we got into this cycle of saying to our organization, what you need to know today is this. It's different from yesterday and it's going to change tomorrow, but today you need to do this. And then what would happen is I would then sit in the corner of the office on a smartphone. I'd record a 10-minute briefing that went out to everyone in the organization to say, right, the nonsense of today is this. This has happened. That's happened. Right. This is what we need you to do to make sense of it. And then following it was all the comms that supported the act, you know, the activity around policy, procedures, et cetera, et cetera. But also it gave me a chance to put things into context and say, God, this has happened today. We don't know the answer on this one yet, but we're working on it. And we got amazing feedback from the organization that seeing you and talking to us and saying that you didn't know the answer or you did know the answer and, you know, knowing that you were there worrying about these things allowed us to calm down and focus on what we needed to do. And then this remarkable thing started to happen that I got one email through from somebody saying this amazing thing had happened today. Could you say thank you to these people? So we did. At the end of my thing, I said, I'd like to shout out this store team. They did this. And then this then developed a life of its own. I was getting like 30 or 40 emails a day where people wanted to say, can I thank that team over there because they did this for us? And can I thank this colleague who delivered this shop into this old lady? and then allowed us to call out all the amazing things the organization was doing. So even in the face of disaster, we were able to say thank you and say well done, and almost create this spirit of we were so proud that we had a very simple focus. So forget the world's best pet care business. We set out with a very simple objective at the start of the pandemic, which said our job is to feed the nation's pets and keep them healthy and happy. That was our job. And it's really simple, but you know what? I think for our colleagues, when they came to work, because we are a mad bunch of passionate pet owners, we recognized that we were there to feed the nation and look after them, you know, the nation's pets, because actually nobody else would. So it helped us sort of reaffirm our purpose again. And all, but you know, you can sort of think about the best pet care business in the world, and that's what you're going to be when you grow up. Actually, our immediate need today was to feed the nation. That was our job. And it really helped us. And what I found was we learned a load of things through this early stages, just the power of just unbelievably honest and caring comms, because it allowed the teams to be connected and feel really in contact. Also, as have a sense of, we're worrying about these things on your behalf, so don't worry about them. We're going to have an answer for you. And I mean, we've always had very high engagement ratings, but actually through this period of time, they went through the roof. And literally my inbox was constantly full of people saying, thank you. You know, can you call this out? And we had these remarkable stories of things that people were doing. And it just kept everybody really motivated and collective and one team and a sense of purpose. It was just amazing. I have to say, I loved it. I absolutely loved it, because it really, I mean, I think you test the culture when things are a disaster. And the reason why we actually performed so well through the crisis, forget financial, I'm talking about why we worked well as an organization, is our culture really carried us through because it was strong going in.
And what is it about that leadership team relationship that you think, because that doesn't come out of nowhere, does it? Like, that must have been there before to carry you through in the pandemic. What is it that's special about the way you run that team?
You know, it's interesting. When I took over at Pets, we actually said goodbye to most of the executive team. There was a bit of, you know, we were not in a good place. And there was only two other colleagues who were from the existing team. And I had to recruit a brand new team. And that was probably the most important thing I did as the CEO, was to handpick every single person who's going to come and join my team and why they were going to join and what role they filled. And then actually I've spent the first year of my life with that team. We invested so heavily in our team performance, us as a team, getting to know each other, understand each other, and recognizing the I of leadership, the we of leadership, and the it of leadership. And we worked with an organization to support us, because you know, everybody turns up to the table with amazing capabilities and skills, don't they? You know, that's the reason why they were recruited. And people are really good at swimming in their lanes. But we're running the organization. So we recognize that our first job was to run the organization. Our second job was, we gave you the responsibility to run a function. Most organizations do it the way around. People turn over the executive table. I'm here to lead people. I'm here to, you know, run logistics. Well, we made a very simple change, saying, no, your job is to run the organization. And I'm empowering you. We are empowering you to run that function on our behalf. And therefore, you have this whole mentality of then people reporting back in and being very clear that when you're sat around that table, you're taking decisions for the organization, not for your function. And we'd worked really, really hard on that as a team before the pandemic. So actually, when the pandemic came along, timing for us was right, because as a team, we were a very, very strong team. This really tested us. But what happened was everybody assumed their role. Everybody had a very clear role to play through the pandemic. And therefore, we'd worked very hard on our trust. So therefore, actually, what we'd found is actually when people came back to the table with their views and their thoughts about something we'd asked them to look at, we just had a really good debate. Because we weren't here to point score. We were here to do the best job for the organization. And I have to say, the team were just remarkable, not just the leadership team, but the whole of the organization. It truly was the most inspiring place to be, because it really felt that we were all trying to do something together. There was no infighting. There was an unbelievable level of support. And, you know, loads of things happened. Our senior leaderships took teams took a pay cut, because we didn't know if we had enough cash at the start. So we took a pay cut. I had store managers ringing me up saying, I want to volunteer a pay cut because I want to make sure we get through. And we're going, actually, we're okay. We don't need you to. And it was just this amazing sense of everybody wanted the organization to come through the other end. And in a way that, you know, I think is, it's why Pets at Home is a remarkable organization to be in, because people here, because they really care about it. But what they do is they care about the people. They care about their teams. They care about pets. There's amazing emotion, I think, that runs through our organization that you've got to really tune into and navigate, because it's so much more than just being paid and doing a job. People care. But that doesn't happen by accident. It happens because we've worked really hard on doing that and building an organization and a culture. So I actually think the leadership team were just exceptional, I have to say. I was so proud. And we navigated it brilliantly and called it really well. You know, I think it was just, it was an amazing experience, actually. And it changed the way that we work completely. We are a different team now than we were going into the pandemic, because a crisis is fantastic, isn't it? Getting you to change the way you behave and what's important. And then, you know, recognizing that the crisis is behind us. You know, for us, we've been open all the way through. So the crisis was like the first 2 months. The rest has just been a big headache coping with the change that comes our way every day.
It must feel wonderful, Peter, to be able to say that you're proud of your leadership team, that organizational ethos that's been created, the culture that you have, values and all those things. But I think it what I was listening to here was the amount of discretionary effort you were getting from your employees and the people in the organization. Mm-hmm. And you don't get that easily. You have to work very hard on culture, on giving, you know, personal emotional effect, if you like.
No, you're absolutely right. I think you've got to recognize that goodwill is like a bank account that you put in and you take out from. And Pets has been brilliant, actually, in this. We run the organization on goodwill, without question. But you've got to recognize that is absolutely a two-way street. And I think it's really interesting. I think, you know, this is for me, when we think about great organizations, they do run on goodwill, because people recognize it's a game where you give and then you take. And if you've always got to give more than you take, by the way, that's the first rule. But I think you recognize that sometimes really simple acts of kindness go a long, 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 long way in terms of getting return. And for me, through the pandemic, there was two things that we did that were so simple, but drove the most amazing levels of goodwill. And they still rumble on today. So the first was, we always had a colleague hardship fund, but we recognized that our people will may be in crisis, not because of their employment position, because actually they were fine, but because their partners, their family hit crisis points. And, you know, simple things like if a washing machine blows up and you're really struggling, the world has just ended. So we recognized that this was going to happen. And right at the very beginning of the pandemic, even when we didn't think we had enough money, we put £1 million to one side. And for us, that was a lot of money. You know, in the context of our business, that's a lot of money to say, we know you're going to have a crisis, but we want you to know, if you have a crisis and you need support, fast support, this is here. And it was really designed for the washing machine blowing up, you know, whatever. Actually, what's happened since, we've buried 10 people whose family members had died through COVID, or have been, you know, they've hit an absolutely horrific situation and they couldn't afford to bury them. I mean, can you imagine? Unbelievable. We've repaired washing machines, we've repaired cars, all things that would stop people coming to work. So, you know, there's a really sound commercial reason for doing it, but actually all these things, and I can tell you now, we've helped 800 people in the last year. And this is now, by the way, we've now decided that the crisis fund is permanent. So we're topping up all the time, because we recognize our people have crisis. And actually when you can help, it's a great way of topping up your goodwill account. The second thing we did, which was really simple, we recognized how hard people had worked through the pandemic. So we decided to close the business on Boxing Day, because we knew that people just wanted time with their families. And, you know, Boxing Day is a big day, as you can imagine, but our people deserved time off. So we closed the whole business for Boxing Day, and we gave everybody just £50 to spend at Tesco on have your Christmas dinner on us. the simplest thing in the world. And oh my God, unbelievable in terms of the response from the organization. Because I think we sometimes forget that something so simple, giving people time and saying, actually have a great Christmas, recognizing that family and time was really important to people. It was like we give everybody a 10 grand pay rise. And, you know, again, it just topped up the goodwill account with our people, recognizing that the act of saying thank you and genuinely meaning it gives you a 50 times return. And I'm surprised more organizations don't think of it in the form of an investment, because every pound I've spent on that, you know, that £1 million into the hardship fund, I think has given me a 10 million return already, because of how people feel in terms of supported, knowing if they hit a hard time, somebody's there to stand behind them and not abandon them. And, you know, at those moments in time where you do hit an absolutely horrific crisis, the fact that we're able to say, we understand and we're here to help. It's a bit like old fashioned employees go back a long, long time. And I think those things are being forgotten as everybody's been squeezing out costs, but actually forgets they serve themselves poor. They're all small, simple things, but they all really matter to our people.
It's so funny you say that. I think it's such a simple thing, and more, I wish more leaders would remember it. But I remember I worked for a leader a while ago, and he said, oh no, I don't think anybody appreciates 20 quid at Christmas. It's only 20 quid. And I was like, no, you're on a six figure plus salary. 20 quid is like 2p to you. But I think that £50 that you were talking about, that's the difference between upgrading your Christmas lunch.
Oh, it is.
For some people, it's having Prosecco. It's not even champagne. That is priceless.
I had this most amazing moment where I went to one of our stores in Lee, and I was speaking to a colleague who happened to work part-time for us and part-time for Tesco. And we, you know, first thing we said is everybody's going to get 50 quid. If you work 1 hour, 50 hours, we're going to give you 50 quid. We're not going to proportion it. And she'd just been given her Christmas bonus from Tesco, which was in the form of Tesco vouchers. And they made it proportionate to her service. She was given a fiver. Wow. And she was telling all her colleagues, I can't believe this. I've been a pet owner for 6 months. They've given me 50 quid's worth of Tesco vouchers. I've been a Tesco for 10 years and they just give me a fiver. And of course you're going, yeah, you know. Yeah. So I think, you know, often you're right. I think small things really do matter. And 50 quid we knew was going to be enough for people just to have a nice Christmas. But you know what? I think what really mattered was it was saying we recognize it's been hard. You know, having Boxing Day off was the best thing we ever could have done, because people wanted 2 days off. They wanted to know on Christmas Day they could have a few drinks, not worry about getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning. That's what really mattered. And I think great leadership really understands the value of those things, because you're connected enough to understand what it means, because you can become so disconnected so quickly.
On that great leadership, so you said you, when you came to Pets, you were there for a while before you became CEO, and you almost created that leadership team again from scratch. But we did scoot over John's initial question, which was, what had you learned from all those other CEOs that you'd gone and spent time with? But also, you have worked for some other, like, exceptional retailers. So you will carry your Asda, as M&S as well.
Yep.
What is it that you'd learn along the way that had helped you make that decision? So is it like another organization that just did it really well, or somebody that had something that hadn't happened so well? I'm just really curious as to what is it that gave you the courage to make such a brave decision?
Yeah. Look, I actually think, firstly, when you become a CEO, it's a combination of your career. Whilst you think you're at the top of the pile, you realize you actually start at the bottom all over again. Because, you know, you start on the bottom of the pile of your list of your experience. So I think firstly, you know, everything that had gone before me was enabling me to try and all of a sudden stabilize us off, you're now in charge. And I've worked for some great organizations. I've worked for some amazing people. I've worked for some absolute knobheads as well. And, you know, along the way, you learn an awful lot from the idiots as well as you do from the great people. And I think 100%. you need both of them, because they help you. So for me, I can't point to one person or one organization apart from you're a sponge and you mop up loads of experiences, and therefore it helps you think about what's appropriate. The other CEO bit was really interesting for me, because I think you can be really quite arrogant when you become a CEO. You know, all of a sudden I've made it. I came from the approach of thinking I've made it shit, somebody's going to discover me. You know, you're going to be really rubbish. Help. And I found other CEOs unbelievably helpful and so generous with their time, just to say, God, I remember when I took over and these are all the things that, you know, I learned. And all of a sudden you're able to speak to somebody else who's been through the same experience as you. And I must admit, it's something I still do now today. If anybody ever reaches out to me, I'm always happy to pick up the phone and share, because, you know, people are so generous with their time, because it's really hard. Because being a CEO, everybody's so critical of you. You know, everybody can do your job better than you, but nobody wants to take the responsibility for the decisions. And, you know, you've got to take both. So for me, I just wanted help. I just wanted, you know, what did you do? Any practical top tips? And I got loads. I got so many words of wisdom of people going, right, now my top advice would be this, or you should focus on this. And it was just really helpful, because firstly, it helped me recognize you're not the first person doing this. You know, others have gone before you, and recognize you're going to get it wrong. That's okay, because you learn from your mistakes, learn quick. And I just got loads of people who sort of 4 or 5 years into their career had relaxed to the point of they realized actually what was really important, what wasn't. And they were able to sort of give you that insight. Because I think when you start on, you put this pressure on yourself to be bloody amazing, but it's the first time you've been appointed. How are you going to be amazing? You know, come on. And I think it really helped me just settle down and just go, don't put pressure on yourself. Be honest with everybody. You know, this is the first time you've done this. It's a bit scary. So I was really open with my teams. I remember standing in front of the retail, you know, the whole of the organization, at one of our conferences, going, actually, first time I've done this. A bit scary, actually, but this is what I'm thinking of, and this is how I'm feeling about it. And these are things that are really important to me. And I really showed up as me in terms of explaining that actually I was a bit scared. And I remember sharing a story that when I got promoted, of course, one of the first things you do is you ring your mum. And, you know, I rang my mum and I was like, you know, mum, just to let you know, I've become the CEO at Pets at Home. And she said, I thought you were already. I was like, no, I wasn't. I was the COO, different. And she's like, oh, right. And then she went, at the end of it, she said, oh, well done. And then she said, it sounds really important. Just don't cock it up.
There's nothing like your mother or your father to ground you, is there?
I know. And I remember sharing that story with the teams, and actually, because I think they forget, because I think sometimes, you know, people forget that when you become the CEO, I think they think that you're born into it. Well, I wasn't. I started on the checkout at Marks & Spencer, and actually I've got there. I've worked my way through there. And I just wanted people to know that actually this is Peter standing up here, not the CEO. And, you know, Peter's a bit scared and he's got these thoughts and these ambitions for the organization, but, you know, it's the first time he's done it and I'm not going to get everything right, but this is what I'm going to try and do. And this is why I'm trying to do it, because ultimately, you know, CEOs are going to come and go with Pets. I'm the fifth in 30 years. And, you know, I sort of think of myself as writing this chapter five. And I described that to the team. I'm writing chapter 5. Please help me make sure that at the end of chapter 5, it's not the end. You know, I'd like it to be, and the story continues on to the next person. Because it allowed me to say, it's Peter standing here. And, you know, this is what Peter stands for. And this is what he's all about. Because ultimately, we work for people, don't we? We have an affinity with people. And it helped that I grew up in the organization. So a lot of people knew me already. But for those who didn't, I want them to see, actually, he's quite real. You know, he's just a bloke doing a job.
Do you think that's that personal connection then, Peter, is the nugget, really? Is it that allows people, your employees, people that work in the organization, to connect on that personal level? And that, and there, because you explained earlier that they have got problems through COVID and what have you, and you set up this fund to help them deal with those. But that means that they must be reading that you're reading that they will have an issue and you're able to help them solve it. And so rather than just this ethereal CEO who sits in his ivory tower, and for me, it seems to be that connection.
Absolutely. You know, I grew up in a council house in Liverpool where we, you know, the washing machine broke, it was a disaster and we couldn't afford to fix it. And I never forget that, you know, so whilst I've got a very lovely life now, you know, I remember, because I started as a colleague too, part-time on a checkout, earning £5 an hour. I know, I understand. And I think in a retail organization, by the way, that really matters. Because I want my team to know that I didn't go to Oxford University and get dropped into this job. Actually, I didn't go to university. I actually went to university later in life because I couldn't afford it. Because I'm just like they are. You know, I didn't have the best education in the world. And also I want them to know actually they can achieve this too. You know, and that's something I'm really proud of in our organization. Part of my job is to create opportunity for people like me, because if somebody hadn't done that, I wouldn't be sat in this job now. I think that people don't see that when you stand on a stage. How could they? So you've got to bring yourself to work. You've got to tell your backstory. I know for me, my backstory is it's not what people expect it to be. You know, I'm an openly gay CEO and went through all the challenges of coming out in work. And, you know, I grew up in a council house in Bootle and we had no money. And every job I've got, I've worked really hard for. And I don't take any of that for granted, but it's what makes me today. But if I don't bring myself to work, people then make it up for themselves.
Yeah.
You know, they just assume that you're the CEO, you earn a shitload of money and you don't care about people. Well, that's not me. So if I had to bring myself to work, they'll bring somebody else to work. And ultimately, you know, I don't mind if people don't like me, that's absolutely fine. But at least give me the opportunity to explain who I am and what I do and what really matters to me. Because ultimately, we work for people. And you want people, you know, if you're a leader, you've got to have followers. And if you've got followers, it doesn't happen by accident. You either have followers because you're a command and control and actually basically you scare the life out of people. And actually, so what you don't have followers, you've got prisoners. Mm-hmm. Or you've got people who choose that they want to follow you because what you're saying they believe in and they want to achieve the same thing as you do. And that collective group of people are going to achieve something together. That's the sort of organization I want to run. Because being the CEO, by the way, I could do the former. I could tell people what to do. And I can have this organization still delivering the same things I want, but I can guarantee the second we stumble, they'll jump on me and kill me because that's what prisoners do. They kill the guard, don't they? Yeah. And you know, but followers, when you trip, they catch you and they get you back up. And that's the sort of organization I want to lead.
I really like that analogy. I really like that. That works very well.
Peter, I'd just like to pick up on one thing that you just mentioned there quite subtly, but you said that you came out during your leadership career at work. Would you mind just telling us what that experience was like, how you prepared for that, what it felt like, and what the out, you know, what did you feel like after?
Yeah. Look, I think it was liberating. I remember it was I was 29, so coming out of work at 29, I was quite old, really. So my closest friends knew, but the organization didn't. And frankly, I just got fed up with people asking me, you know, what does your girlfriend or your wife do? I'm thinking, well, yeah, that's a bit presumptuous, isn't it? Yeah. But I got to a point of really all of a sudden, I remember, and it's back to this point about bringing yourself to work. The person I was bringing to work was a different person to the person that was really me. And I was tired of it. I was tired of, you know, playing the corporate, you know, this is what I'm expected to be. And the pressure it was putting on myself for trying to be something that I felt like I wasn't just being authentic to myself.
What level were you at then?
I was a director at Asda. I was the youngest ever director at Asda at the age of 29. And I got there really fast and had the most amazing time. But I actually recognized that I wasn't doing myself a service. I was actually trying to be somebody else because the environment I was in at the time, it was quite a blokey culture.
Just for like our younger listeners to just give them the context, it was phenomenally different.
Oh God, yeah. I mean, honestly,
now it's
a sort of in this, what, 20 years ago, completely different. And it was quite a blokey culture. You know, people used to talk about sport on a Monday morning. I'm thinking, you know, I know a bit about Liverpool, but I don't really follow. You know, I just felt really uncomfortable, and I increasingly was feeling uncomfortable in my own skin. And I remember, you know, I didn't make a big deal about it. I just sort of told a few people and you would tell everybody else. And that was probably how I did it.
Okay.
So it made me feel comfortable. But actually, you know what? What I found was amazingly how many people just came up to me and said, actually, thanks for that. You know, I really respect you because I know it was difficult. And actually, I've got to say, I did face a fair degree of stigma as a consequence of it because the world was just a bit different then. And in the end, I recognized that what I thought was my problem was somebody else's problem. And it just allowed me to relax a bit more. And I think ever since that moment, you know, I had a conversation recently where I talked about, I think every leader has a coming out moment. And it's the coming out of themselves,
isn't
whatever that
ironic?
Is.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah.
And I think we all do, because I think that's, and it brings it back, the second you can come out as yourself, whatever that looks like, whoever that is, it just gets you enormous respect, I think, from the organization, because they go, ah, right, he's normal, actually, because there is no definition of normal. We've all got labels and stuff. But I think what it suddenly means is all of a sudden people can associate with you. And those associations are so powerful. You know, whether you're the council house kid, the scouser, whatever label you want to attach, people can associate with you and go, actually, you're like me, really, aren't you? And that is really powerful.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I think, you know, what you've just articulated then, I think will make a lot of sense to a lot of people. How is, you know, I'm thinking about my experience of being a Pets at Home customer, and I shared with you before we started this conversation, I live in Doncaster, not the most affluent area, but I can absolutely see how you as a CEO would resonate with somebody in Doncaster in that store. Do you know what I mean? And like that they can, they're happy to follow you. I think that your personality probably fits a brand like Pets at Home very well for that. How long did it take you to find that fit? How long did it take you to find your tribe and a place where you could be you, but also that your followers would really appreciate you for being you?
I think the first place where I really felt comfortable was Asda. When I was at Asda, it was very much about you were there to serve the underserved. And, you know, your job was to make sure that 30 quid people walked in with, you walked out with as many carry bags as possible. And I got that. I really understood that. So I felt very at home at Asda because it was very purpose-led. And I think this is the point. I think for me, I could never work in an organization that didn't have a purpose that wasn't greater than making money. You know, that's the output of what we need to do to invest in our business. That's core business, isn't it? But for me, this is where purpose really comes in. And the reason why I chose to come to Pets, it was the smallest job I'd ever done in the smallest company I'd ever done, is I loved what the organization was trying to do. You know, it looks after pets. And frankly, as a lifelong pet owner, that was great. I love the people. I love the passion in the organization. And I think sometimes when you can find your home, your tribe, actually life is just wonderful. And because you just become your best. And I'm really thankful for Pets because it's really allowed me to settle in and allow me to be me. Because most of the organizations, and I can think some of the organizations I worked with on the web, actually, they wanted you to be something else. They wanted you to be a clone. They wanted you to be suited and booted. And they weren't really that interested in you. They just wanted to deliver, you know, they wanted to deliver a result. And when I look back through my career now, I can recognize why I stayed at some places for 2 years and some places for 13 years. Because you know when you feel at home in somewhere. And you know, my advice to anybody who's ever started out their career is always find somewhere where you like the people and you know you like the organization. Because if you do, you're probably going to do well. And if you don't, run a mile because you're late it. I think you come across it. Because I think, again, as you mature your way through, and I think I'm still mature, and even though I'm in my 50s, you learn loads of things. But I recognized success for me comes in having the right environment where you feel really comfortable, you feel like you're welcome, you feel like your views are understood, you're understood as a person, and therefore you can thrive. And I think that does come through. You know, you've got to kiss a lot of frogs, I think, to find those places. But when you do, you know, recognize they're really, really special. And you stay around. That's why I've been a pet for 11 years. I love it. So I think we all have our tribes. I think it's just a hard job trying to find them.
Is there a typical day as a CEO then, Peter? Is there a sort of a mantra that you follow? Is there a process that you follow, or is it just very varied?
I think the first thing is you recognize that much of your time is not your own. And I think you go through, I went through a bit of an identity crisis because I think you spend most of your career doing stuff, delivering an output. And the more senior you become, you suddenly realize that you actually don't do anything. I remember once I had an assistant who I said to her, I said, what do you think I do? She said, you do meetings. That's what you do. That's probably a good description of what I do. I do meetings. But you suddenly, I think firstly, you recognize that your job is actually not to deliver a thing. Actually, your job is an enablement to help other people. So I would say, you know, my days are just so randomly varied, which is what I love about it. You know, so there's a whole load of set things you've got to do. And, you know, I love the fact that I interface with shareholders, customers, colleagues. You know, we're opening a new distribution center. So I went to dig the first spade of soil 2 weeks ago, and you get to do some lovely things. But I think what you recognize is your job is the whole thing. So what you want to do is you want to get out and about and as far and wide as you can in the business, into every nook and cranny in every function. And therefore, it's very varied. So the only consistency to my day is a cup of coffee about 7:45 of the morning. And then I normally wind down about 5:30 at night. So I'm very defined about my working day. Very defined. I don't work weekends. I don't work evenings, actually. Because actually, if I do, so does the rest of the organization, and we don't need to. But inside of that, my job really is about enabling other people to get on and get things done, because some things have to come through you. Other things you can enable and other things you can just support. So my time increasingly is about where I'm best spending my time to help the organization deliver its goals.
It fits nicely, doesn't it, with that mutual learning model, that having a learning organization rather than that command and control where you are sort of doing things quite a lot, doing things to people probably that they're not.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong, Petter Home is a bit of a command and control organization. It's got to be when you're running, you know, 450 stores and you want consistency. I think the difference is it's command and control wrapped in a velvet glove, which, you know, doesn't thump you, it nudges you and pushes you in the right direction, but gives you an awful lot of freedom as well. So it's command and control within a framework in quite a gentle, nudging, encouragement environment. Rather than commanding and control is worse, it shouts at you, it tells you what to do and tells you not to think. I think you do need command and control, otherwise you've got chaos. So I think what you've got to do is just give people freedoms and recognize how far they can go. And at what point in time, probably they need to check in with somebody else.
Yeah, I think that's probably the difference, because a lot of the service level organisations that we deal with, or like higher education, they can really step away from command and control. But I think when you're the retail aspect of it, when you have got people on lower, they just come to work to I know they don't, they obviously come to work for the purpose, but they also do need an aspect of, yeah, I want you to tell me what to do. So it's that, I like that velvet glove analogy. And I actually hadn't really reflected that, but you are so laid back, just even talking to you now. You know, you've been a CEO, been so generous with your time, you've got a really relaxed aura about you that I'm just reflecting as a customer. I mean, my dog weed in one of your stores the other day, and everybody was so relaxed. And actually, maybe that is that velvet glove, just, oh yeah, some blue roll over there and that. And nobody ever seems stressed in any of your stores.
But you shouldn't be, because, you know, God, if your dog doesn't wee, and actually we have much worse than that. that's just, you know, we get that, we're pet owners, that's just life, it's fine. But just come back to something you said there, Rachel, actually, I think this is a crucial bit, is, you know, often you associate people's capability with how much money you pay them. Mm. Well, the first thing is, we don't employ children in our organization. Typically, you've got to be over 18 years of age to work for us. Most of our teams have got driving licenses. They've got mortgages. They've got children. They have incredibly complicated lives. And so the things that we ask them to do are pretty straightforward and simple. Yeah,
quite.
And actually, therefore, what we find is, if you give people empowerment to say, actually, this is the framework we wanted to operate in, this is why we're doing it, but you make the judgment call to do the right thing, we get amazing results. Because if you don't, what you get stupid results, because people follow rules. And I think, and we're going through it, we're still learning in this space, is recognizing that actually, you know, you hear about empowerment, but actually what we try and think about is, we employ adults, so let's have adult to adult conversations, let's explain why we do stuff, let's explain what it is we're trying to achieve, and then encourage the creativity of the organization to find solutions. And, you know, we talked a little bit about COVID, but actually most of the solutions we implemented in COVID were store-based solutions. Mm-hmm. We gave the stores a challenge and said, look, this is what we're thinking of, can you modify it before we roll it? Because, you know, we have 15,000 people in our organization. If you don't employ and use the power of those 15,000 adults to make great decisions, you're really not setting your organization free. So I think part of that relaxedness is a sense of also, you know, there's certain things we're really just zero tolerance on. You know, we just health and safety, pet welfare, the rules are the rules. And as you step outside of them, it's like the law, dead, black and white. But then what we do is we have, you know, if they're the laws, we then have rules, and rules are there to help you to make decisions. And we give you that freedom. And you know, when stuff goes wrong, the first thing I always try to think about is, what was somebody's intent? Did they intend to be really stupid? Or did things conspire against them? And actually it was unfortunate. Okay. And therefore, I think you've got to be quite forgiving to say, when bad stuff happens, you know, if somebody's intent was good, but it just was badly executed, that's different to when somebody sets out to be stupid. Well, we don't employ stupid people. You don't want them in our organization.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You certainly get that sense as being a customer. Yeah, you definitely have some nice conversations with adults, don't you, about your pet. My pet's definitely a bit of a character. He's usually up on the counter wanting a fuss, or you know, and people are just really forgiving about that.
But the thing is, though, just back to that, this is a real secret about our business, though, is we know that the way we connect to customers, by the way, is through pets. And the analogy I always have is, you know, if you sort of think about a park bench, and if you were sat on a park bench, Rachel, with your dog, and somebody came up and spoke to you through the dog, oh, what a beautiful dog, what age is he, or you know, you'd engage in conversation.
Yeah.
And if somebody turns up on the park bench with a similar dog to you, you two are off and away.
Yeah.
But if you sat on the park bench by yourself and somebody came to speak to you, you'd be running off and say, off your rape alarm, you know, and it's a freak, isn't it? So we recognize that in our world, we always connect through the pets, because actually you can have the most amazing conversation. And often it's why our colleagues will know the name of the pet. So we haven't got a clue about the name of the customer. But again, this is how we think and how we tune in. So actually what we try and get to is, you know, when I think about pets, what we try and get to is common sense, behaviors, thinking about real life, how stuff really works, and try not to be so precious about, you know, we've got so much that we're rubbish at, and we're trying really hard, and we can't be perfect all the time, but we try really, really hard to get it right. And when we get something wrong, we put our hands up and we fix it and we move on. And I think that sort of laid backness is missing in most organizations, because they set themselves a standard that they can never achieve, and therefore all you ever do is fail. And you fail in the eyes of your customer, and you know, you don't engage with people well, because the way I'm describing how I engage with my colleagues is how I want my colleagues to engage with my customers, which is just be yourself. You know, it's fine.
What you've just explained, though, then, is literally my relationship with being a pet owner. I have made some catastrophically bad decisions regarding my pet, but my intention's always been good. Do you know what I mean? You're like, oh, why did I do that? Why did I leave that chicken on the side? Why did I do that? Why did I leave him locked in? You know, and the intent's good, right? But you learn and you become a better pet owner as you have become a better leadership team. It sounds like you are in a phenomenally good place. I can't say that word. You know what I mean? But obviously, you know, this real sense of learning and what John calls a learning organization. What is next for you on this leadership team journey with pets? Like, what are the next things that you're tackling? Because it certainly doesn't sound like you've got it perfect, but you're on this constant journey. So where's your head going to the next year or two?
I think the next big challenge for us is setting our organization free to serve. And what I mean by that is removing every ounce of rubbish that stops people from doing their jobs really well, by giving them more time to serve customers better, giving them more freedom to look after their customers better. You know, most retailers are obsessed about taking people out of the equation. I would never even contemplate taking service out of my organization. In fact, I want to put more service in, because I think great organizations put service at the forefront of what they're trying to do. And actually, you know what? Most great service actually comes through people. You know, technology can make things convenient, but there's nothing like coming into a shop or a practice and you want to have a chat about something because you're really worried and concerned. You can do it with a chat bot, but they're so frustrating, aren't they? Because they just still don't answer your question. So for me, it's about this next stage of freeing our organization to spend more time doing the things that really matter and setting our people to free to serve in every aspect of, you know, if the computer can do the job really well, let them do it. So our people can spend time on the really hard stuff to make the organization better. So even today, when I think about our journey about becoming the best pet care business, I think we're on a sort of a 4 out of 10 we've come from a two, we're on a four, but there's loads of things that we still haven't done and still want to do. And that's about making the organization more robust, more responsible. I think what I mean responsible, I mean the impact that we leave behind us as an organization on society, on our communities, on the planet, on pets, on pet welfare. So for me, I think we're at a stage where we've got lots of things going well, but actually I'd like us to be a great organization by really pushing those boundaries and really starting to show more about the things that are really important to us and that we know are important to our pet owners. But the only way we're going to get there is by giving our people more time to do that. And the way that we do that is by helping set them free. And it sounds really ambitious. I think that's going to take us a good few years to do that because, you know, we're fortunate. The pet market's growing. That's great. So I'm pretty happy that we'll probably still see a growing revenue of business. But the thing that will really define us as a great brand won't be in sales or in revenue. Customers will never thank us for that. We'll be actually, do we increasingly do a better job to serve them? Mm. And I genuinely believe that will be done through people, by the way, not through tech, through people. And through allowing our people with them, who have got the most amazing, amazing expertise, let them loose on more customers.
Yeah, I love that. I think particularly as, you know, my dog's a rescue dog. So I love that more people have got dogs and pets through the pandemic, but I also get very worried that people that don't really know how to care for them are getting them. And I think, you know, when you talk about the world and pet care, whether you'd thought about humans are, I think, have a lot of good intentions, but are we perhaps turning our pets into the worst version of us in some ways? You know, these uber spoiled pets, these overweight pets, you know, you kind of start to see pets mirroring our society.
Oh, they always have. They always have done. So pet, everything that comes into our life is a reflection of what goes on in the broader society. And look, I think we recognize that the pet is never wrong, ever. So we recognize that the job we've got to do is train humans, not pets. You know, so if a dog's barking, the dog's barking for a bloody good reason, fix that. You know, don't get it, don't try and shut the dog up, understand what the cause is and address that. And so, you know, I think we recognize that our job is about training pet owners to help them impart the knowledge and experience that we've got, both as pet owners and, you know, we've got very, you know, incredibly well qualified colleagues to help educate customers on the best way to care for their pet. Whether that be, you know, if you feed your pet the right things, actually, you often find that a lot of things will be good. You know, so what comes out the back end will be good. The coat will be good. The teeth will be good. There's one problem solved. Then focus on behavior. You know, so if you don't, you know, people try and treat their pet as if it's a human, it's not. In pet worlds, there are very clear hierarchies. You know, the dogs are pack animals. Cat is all about power. Yeah. And once you start to explain the why, so, you know, when my cat started doing things I didn't want him to do, you know, I didn't appreciate him weeing on my sofa. But once you understand why, because actually for him it was about territory. So what's threatening his territory, and you get to the root cause. Again, I was speaking to some people who were helping me work my way through. The problem solved. Whereas actually people actually then say the cat's bad, let's get rid. Actually, you've got to change that environment. But we know that and we can help. And that's where, when I really talk about our role is from a pet care point of view, is helping people be really good pet owners. Because when you get it right, it's magical. Because the companionship, the love, the amazing thing that pets do for our lives, it's amazing. They teach about life. They teach about responsibility. They teach about death. They teach about all those things. We think that's amazing. But we've got to train our pet owners to be the best that they can be. And that's, for me, you know, why I'm so passionate about setting our colleagues free, because we can really help people. And by the way, along the way, we sell stuff, which is great, but that's not the reason why we sell stuff. Because if we can help you solve a problem, you'll decide to buy it with us or somebody else anyway. Yeah. And so I think you're right on all of those things, but that really gets you back to the why.
It does, yeah. That's the reiteration of your purpose for the next couple of years. Yeah, love it.
How do you feel... things may change, Peter, going forward now that quite a lot of people have got pets through the lockdown period and people are starting to return to work. And I've seen quite a few things, even just on LinkedIn, where people are asking questions about, can they take their pet to work, or will they still be able to work from home so they can still look after the pet? It's all that education thing, isn't it, for the pet owner Do you think things will change?
Yeah. I mean, they will constantly change. So, you know, when I grew up, you know, even 20 years ago, most dogs used to live in the backyard, and now they live on the sofa or on your bed. You know, we're in an environment where actually, you know, when we built this office, we thought about the pets first. You know, our pets here have got a play park. We've put down surfaces that are fine for the dogs. They've got their own kitchen. They've got their own tuck shop. You know, they've got places to be safe. And so for me, I think this is where, if you're an employer, by the way, or you're somebody serving customers, people who've got pets are big spenders. You know, so actually this is for me, of course, there are so many more pets. Really smart employees now say, God, this is really important for our colleagues. And there's a war for talent. So why would I say goodbye to somebody who wants to bring their pet to work and I'm going to say goodbye to an amazing talent rather than how do I facilitate that? Because actually, in our experience, bringing pets to work is amazing. It is amazing. It calms the office down. People are so much more engaging. Conversations are better. The pets are so much better behaved than the colleagues in my experience. You know, it creates a wonderful environment. So for me, it will find its level. It always does. And, you know, I'm a bit more worried about people will suddenly discover that if you allow people to bring their pets to work, you get a better quality of recruitment. We do. We've discovered this. We've known that secret for years, which is why we recruit some amazing people because they can bring their dog to work. How amazing is that? So I think he's going to change and it will constantly change. And the reason why is because pets are playing a bigger role in our lives without question. And just ask any dog owner or cat owner about how they feel about their pet and would they sacrifice their pet for something else? And the answer often will be no. I'll sacrifice the places I choose to shop, the places I choose to eat, places I choose to work.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, my dog has probably been the most, it's been harder having my dog than my child. Like he was a real, it was difficult, wasn't he, John? Yeah, it's very difficult. Like $3,000 worth of damage and he's from Cyprus rescue dog, but we persevered and he's the most rewarding thing now. Like I just love him so much. Right. I look at him and I think that's like my life's achievement is giving him a safe place to live.
I know. But just think though, Rachel, that your dog's not going to come home with a drink problem or a drug problem. And, you know, he might get next door's bitches pregnant, but, you know, that's probably the worst you're going to have to deal with. But you can even deal with that.
To be fair, the worst deed was he's a real scavenger. He's got his head in like a pizza that somebody's left over the road and I have to deal with what comes out the other end. Like we have had that a few times, but yeah, he's a lot easier to deal with than a lot of other people I've worked with before.
But the great thing, the thing we always find, actually, the great thing about pet is just the unconditional love that they give.
Yeah.
And I think that's for me is actually, you know, I've been a lifelong pet owner and I've got a cat. And even though my cat is just, I mean, is the most loving, beautiful cat in the world, he's just a murderer. He just kills the local population of anything, but we still love him.
Yeah.
And you know, if anybody ever touched my cat, I'd kill them because you know it's the love that I get back and how I feel about him is just a really important part of my life.
Yeah, but the mental health, you know, we talk a lot about well-being programs and things like that, but just the mental well-being and the positive endorphins. Well, it's oxytocin, isn't it? That's what pets give you. On that note, it would be amiss of us to kind of just get you to share like your leadership essentials for somebody who's, you know, wanting to become a senior leader like you or on a leadership journey. What would be your three leadership essentials?
Oh gosh, that is a great question. I think I think the first one I'd say, and I've mentioned this quite a few times, is bring the real you to work. And what's holding you back from doing so? I think when you can bring the real you with, you know, all of the impurities and imperfections that you have, I think the most amazing thing happens, which is you form fantastic relationships with people because they trust you. And you know, back to that earlier point, if you're going to be a great leader, do you have followers or do you actually have prisoners? And I think in my experience, people follow leaders because they associate with them. And I think when you see somebody's imperfection, there's something about the British psyche. When you see somebody's imperfection, you put your arm around them. When you think they're perfect, you try and expose them. So I think bring yourself to work. I think the second thing is back to this point of you've got to relax and be supportive and be realistic, because there's a danger that you just live in this idealistic world that just doesn't exist. And it's really important as a leader, you actually know how to use your judgment, when to back people, when to support people, when to allow people to fail safely and help them learn the lessons that they need to learn, even though you're going to tell them it's not going to work, let them learn it. And you've got to create the environment that actually allows supportiveness and realistic in equal measures, because it means actually the organization learns and that they learn. And you also want to make sure that in an organization, you want to make sure that somebody's got your back. I think the final thing is be really kind. Allow people to have their crisis. Support them through it, because that emotional bank account, that goodwill bank account, for every pound you put in, you get a 10 times reward back. And when you think about organizations that you've worked in, the point at which often things really matter is when you want somebody to be kind and support you, because it was about the ordinary, it was something that was very personal to you. And when you see that kindness back, I just think you're forever in debt, because you know that's a rare commodity. And if you can show it, I just think it becomes contagious, for one. And I think secondly, creates this most amazing environment where actually you feel valued.
We've not had that one before, so that's a really lovely leadership essential that you finished on there, Peter. Thank you. John, any final questions?
It was an interesting one, actually, that be kind, because we did talk to a business psychologist a couple of weeks ago. He was saying it's harder to be that person. It's quite easy to be the hard ass in some respects, but it's quite hard to be kind and have the amount of time that you have to give to people to understand their situation. So I think that that's a really, really strong leadership essential. Mm-hmm. And the first one that you mentioned, bring you to work, it's always puzzled me, because I've often heard people say that, well, I'm this person at work and then I'm this person out of work. And it always puzzled me, because, well, which one is you?
Mm. Absolutely. Yeah. It's not being bipolar, is it?
Yeah.
In that respect. No, I agree. Look, I think the thing just on the be kind, often being kind also means you can be really tough.
Yeah.
I think it's about recognizing that kindness is about being honest with somebody, and at the same time as being supportive and nice to somebody. And I think that kindness, but I think that's where it comes back almost down to, you know, being truthful.
Yeah.
I think it really matters, rather than actually, I think it's easy to be kind in a nice sense, I think. But I think it's getting the balance of those two right, so people know that actually you're doing things because it's the best interest. And it's a bit like, you know, I think sometimes when people say, you know, do I look fat in this? Yeah, you do actually. It just didn't flatter you at all. No, that's being kind, you know, because you're telling somebody the truth.
I don't want you to go out looking.
Exactly. You know, I'm protecting you from yourself. But no, I think all those things really matter. But I think, you know, all these things come back down to ultimately, I think we're human beings, aren't we? And none of us are perfect. We're all trying to do the very best that we can. And I just think real leadership is actually, it comes back down to that absolute authenticity of your value set, whatever that value set is, and being clear about them so people understand you and they know what they're going to get from you. And I think that's actually what works really, really well in that environment. And it's really hard, I think, in a corporate environment to do that, by the way. I think it's really hard to be relaxed, so hard. Mm. And I think it takes time together. But I think also when you do, I actually also think it becomes the point where actually your career becomes the most enjoyable too.
Wonderful. Final question. How does your mum think you've done?
Well, sadly, my mum's no longer with us, it's very sad. But she had a great life, so I'm not feeling sad about it, because my mum was amazing. You know, my mum was always like, my mum was, frankly, I used to remember bringing things home from woodwork, and the first thing she used to always say is, oh, it's lovely. And the next question would be, what is it? So my mum was always incredibly supportive. So I think, frankly, you know, the greatest gift my mum and dad gave us as kids, and we had four kids, and it wasn't the easiest upbringing, is they gave us the most amazing values. And I sort of think of everything I've been talking about today, they were the things that my mum and dad taught us to do. So my mum and dad were always proud, frankly, because they were proud of the way that their kids behaved. they're always very proud that we did things the right way, that we were good people and we were nice people. And I think that was always the benchmark. My mum was never impressed by title because, frankly, I mean, when I worked at Asda, she thought I put the chips out for 13 years because, you know, that's what you do in Asda. She had no idea of all the machine that goes on behind it. So she never really understood what I did. But if she ever saw my name in the paper or saw my picture in the paper or the odd times on TV, she was very proud because she could point her friends at the bingo to it. But I think probably mum and dad are most proud of actually they brought up four very rounded kids who have all done respectively well for themselves and whatever they've done, either as parents or as CEOs.
Wonderful. What a nice legacy she's left them, really. Thank you so much for your time. Really, really appreciate it. It's just been such a great interview. Really inspiring.
Thank you, Peter. We've done a lot of smiling today on this podcast. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to the Building Better Leaders podcast. We hope you found today's leadership essentials and coaching discussion points useful. If you'd like to read more about the approach we take, check out our website at scaffoldcoaching.com.